The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Good morning. Welcome to the Trumpet Daily Show. I'm your host, Robert Morley, and I will be filling in for Stephen Flurry, who is out. But don't worry, he'll be back tomorrow. I'm very excited to be with you today. For those of you who are just turning in, you are listening to KPCG.FM 101.3 on the FM dial, or perhaps you're listening in via SoundCloud or thetrumpet.com. Regardless of how you're listening in, thank you very much for joining us today. We have a... well, what I think is a truly amazing story for you. I think it's a story that perhaps you may not have appreciated, and I think it's a story that's really unlike any other in history. This is a story about a small, isolated, lonely, windswept cluster of islands that became the biggest empire in history. And it did so in a way that some historians call a fit of absent-mindedness, by accident, you might say. But one of the things we'll look at today is, you know, was it really an accident? Did this all happen by chance? Did a tiny island become an empire by chance? Or was there really an unseen hand, a force working behind the scenes to ensure that this tiny, tiny nation became this superpower? That's the subject of today's Trumpet Daily. How is it possible that the tiny nation of Britain became the most fantastic empire in history? And this is a story that's important for Americans to understand too, because the same forces that made this tiny island nation so great also turned the United States into a superpower. And just as Great Britain lost its superpower status, those very same forces that tore it apart, they're now working in America, here too, today. America is sailing down that same sea lane that Britain sailed down just a few decades ago. So today, let's go ahead and consider the story of Great Britain. If you, taking a look at Great Britain at its peak, at the peak of prosperity, you see a lot of similarities with America, and you really see a nation that was unrivaled in the world. In the 20th century, the British Empire covered almost a quarter of the land surface on Earth. Now think about that. It's easy to read over something like that or hear something like that and just move on. But the British Empire controlled one quarter of all the land on this Earth. That's astounding. And it wasn't just uninhabited wasteland or land that nobody wanted. I mean, it would be somewhat easy for a nation to control land that nobody wanted. But some of the pieces of territory the British Empire contained were the choicest pieces of real estate on Earth, with huge metropolitan population centers. Looking at this empire, it was, geographically speaking, it was the largest empire in history. People talk a lot about the Babylonians or the Romans or the Mongolian Empire. But the British Empire usurped all of those empires, every other empire in history, and by a long shot, too. And it's at its height in the 1900s, just to put things in comparison, it was three times larger than its next closest colonial competitor. That was the French. And the French, a lot of their territory was Sahara Desert, right? It was land that was useless, that nobody wanted. The German Empire, the British Empire was 10 times the size of the German Empire. Britain was ruling over 500 million people. That's an incredible amount considering how tiny that island nation was. It was the people in the British Isles numbered less than 50 million at that point, actually significantly less than that. Back at that time, people were talking about, you've heard the saying, the sun never set on the British Empire. And the reason people said that was because it was true. It was absolutely true. Regardless of where you were on Earth, at some point there was British territory that the sun was shining on. I had a list of nations in front of me earlier this morning. that just showed all the different nations that were part of the British Empire. How many nations do you think were part of the British Empire? Just take a guess out there. What do you think? You know, 20, 25? We know it was an empire. We know it was big. It was expansive. Today in the world, there's 196 countries that make up the world around us today. Of those 196 nations, 59 were at one point controlled by Great Britain. 59 of 196 nations. That's more than 30% of the nations in this world were controlled by Great Britain. And they weren't just tiny nations either, right? Yeah, yes, there were a lot of small nations. There were some of these tiny nations. There was the Fijis or the Solomon Islands or Barbados or Bahamas. There were those small nations, but there were also many huge, huge nations that were controlled by Great Britain. Canada, right? The land, some people have called the breadbasket of the world, filled with forests and fisheries. Great Britain controlled Australia, a whole continent on this earth. New Zealand, probably the greenest place I've ever been to on earth. People say it's the greenest place outside of Ireland. South Africa, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Egypt, Nigeria. These are major, major countries of this world. And they all flew that Union Jack flag. At one point, you could travel from Cape Town, South Africa, from the very, very south of the continent of Africa, all the way to Cairo, Egypt, and not leave British territory. Cape to Cairo. Rail line. I think you had to change gauges a couple times, change trains because the rail gauges were different. But you didn't have you go all the way across the continent and not leave British territory. And that in Africa, that transversed some of the choicest piece of land in Africa too. You know, Rhodesia, Kenya, South Africa itself, etc. And Great Britain also controlled some of the most strategic real estate as well. You know, not just the biggest country. I think Canada is the second biggest country in the world, but they also controlled pieces of real estate that, you know, geopolitical analysts consider some of the most strategic in the world, even to this day. Nations like Egypt, right, with the Suez Canal that controlled the exit of the Mediterranean, that gateway from the Mediterranean Sea to the Indian Ocean, that was controlled by Great Britain. On the other end of the Mediterranean, Gibraltar, that chunk of rock at the very southern tip of Spain that controlled the entrance to the Mediterranean. You know, with those two colonies, with Gibraltar on the one end and Egypt on the other, Britain controlled pretty much the whole Mediterranean. The Mediterranean Sea basically became a British lake, right? You throw in Cyprus and Malta, and no nation since the days of the Roman Empire so completely controlled the Mediterranean Sea. These were super, super strategic pieces of real estate. Hong Kong, right? Situated on the Pearl River, the gateway to southern China. Singapore, right on the Straits of Malacca, right where so much of the world's shipping, even today, is forced to pass by. The Falkland Islands, the gatekeeper to the southern route around South America, controlled by Great Britain. Cape Town, controlling the southern route around South Africa. Pretty much wherever global trade moved, Britain was there controlling it. The Union Jack flag was flying. The British Empire probably got the closest to global domination that any nation has ever achieved. Just reading from the St. James Gazette back in Queen Victoria's day, it wrote, talking about Queen Victoria, it said, it described the British Empire this way. It said, the Queen Empress, you know, talking about Queen Victoria, held sway over one continent, 100 peninsulas, 500 promontories, 1,000 lakes, 2,000 rivers, 10,000 islands. I mean, there's a postage stamp that the British produced that showed the world and a map showing British holdings, and it said, quote, we hold a vaster empire than has ever been. And they did. And as vast as that reach was, as extensive as that territory was, it was actually underestimated. I mean, that just included the territory that was formally under British control. But for example, you know, Britain invested so much money around the world. It invested in countries like like Argentina and Brazil, and they sunk so much money into those countries that historians talk about, you know, informal imperialism in those countries, the economic imperialism of Great Britain. It actually expanded its reach far beyond where it actually ruled, where it actually had governors in place. You know, then there was Britain's commercial negotiations that pushed large sectors of the world economy to accept British trade and free trade, really, and thus British economic rule. Britain was the world's banker. It invested huge sums of money around the world. You know, between 1865 and 1914, the start of World War I, more British money was invested in the Americas, in North America and South America, than in Britain itself. I mean, these British companies were going out around the world. They were conquering the world economically as well. By 1914, the beginning of World War I, between two-fifths and one-half of all foreign-owned assets were British. Now, almost one-half of all the assets around the world that were owned by foreign nations, you know, outside of their land, were British. I mean, that's astounding. No economy before or since then has held such a large proportion of its assets overseas. No nation before today, up to today, has had such economic influence around the world. And Britain even set the standard for the monetary system, kind of like the dollar does today. The U.S. dollar today is, right, the gold standard that the world operated on. That was a result of Britain's economic system being exported around the world. You know, prior to the gold standard, a lot of countries operated different bimetallic systems, the silver standard. But as Britain rose to prominence, the world adopted its economic system to compete with the British. The pound sterling became the world's reserve currency, just like the dollar is the world's reserve currency today. And because of this vast influence, all these things that we've been talking about, Britain's economic might, it's the geographical extent of Britain, the institutions we have today, the world we know today, in large measure, is the product of Britain's age of empire. You know, that's how widespread, that's how dominant Britain became. We are still living the legacy, in many ways, of the British Empire. As a historian, Neil Ferguson says, he says, it can be argued that the spread of capitalism, telecommunications, the English language, and the institutions of representative government can all be traced back to the extraordinary expansion of Britain's economy, its population, and culture. And Great Britain really did become just a dominant force in this world. It became even a role model for many nations. Nations like Germany talked a lot about wanting an empire like Britain's. They wanted the power that they saw Britain had. Yet, here's what I consider the most amazing part of this story. The most amazing part of the British Empire. And that's the simple fact that Britain didn't set out to become a global empire. It never set out to become this company of colonies or this company of nations or a commonwealth of nations. There was no national policy of imperialism. You know, the term British imperialism didn't even come into being until Britain was basically at the point where it was losing its colonies, where it was fighting tooth and nail to hang on to its colonies. The history book Seeley's Expansion of England, it's a pretty famous textbook, but it's famous because of what Seeley wrote about how Britain became an empire. And he famously wrote, quote, "We seem to have conquered and peopled half the world in a fit of absence of mind." Now, think about that statement. You know, this is a historian. These are, you know, people who study history, and they look at how Britain attained its empire, and, you know, people are saying that it was by accident, that it was by a fit of absence of mind, absent-mindedness. Neil Ferguson talks a little bit about this in his book. His book's called The Empire, The Rise and Demise of the British World Order. And as he points out in there, he says it wasn't even until Joseph Chamberlain that Britain had its first authentically, you know, self-consciously, actively imperialist politician. But even men like Chamberlain and Disraeli before him really talked about imperialism in the sense of bringing the empire together, unifying the empire, integrating the empire together, keeping it together, not in the sense of expanding it. And that's really because Britain already had most of the empire at that point. They were just trying to hang on to it, to keep it, you know, just like Winston Churchill was when he came to power. But, you know, at this point, it's important to ask, you know, how was all this possible? All these things we've talked about describing just how vast and huge and influential the British Empire was. How is that possible? How is it possible that this tiny little nation up in the North Atlantic, the cold North Atlantic, could have accomplished such astounding, astounding feats? You know, is it possible that it really was by accident, you know, in a fit of absence of mind or absent-mindedness? You know, is that logical? Well, if you were to pick up a globe or a world map or pull one up online and you were to look and try to and look at the world and pick out one country that you thought most probably could become a superpower. Of all the nations in the world, Great Britain would not be an obvious choice, right? I think it would be way down the list for most people. Yet the fact remains that somehow it became the biggest empire in history, right? Absolutely dwarfing the Roman Empire. I mean, Britain was a province, a small, remote province in the Roman Empire. Yet somehow it became the center of the world by the 20th century. The world revolved around Great Britain. And this really is an important question to understand. We need to understand, you need to understand why Great Britain became the most expansive empire the world has ever seen. And the reason you need to understand this is because you will change your understanding of the world. You will revolutionize your understanding of the future and of what is happening in the world today. You know, how is it that Britain got to be so incredibly wealthy? How did it get to be so incredibly expansive in the first place? This is an important question. We need to understand this because if you can understand why it became so powerful, then you can also understand why it lost its empire, why it lost it so quickly and so dramatically, why it's losing its wealth so rapidly today. And you can understand the relevance to America today because if you look at America, America is in a very similar place that Britain was at the height of its empire. Now, the Bible reveals the answers to these questions. It reveals the answers to why Britain became so great and why it fell so fast. So let's begin by asking, you know, what makes nations great? You know, why, what separates nations from each other? Why do some grow and others shrink? You know, why is it that one quarter of the world's people today speak English? Even today, a quarter of the world speaks English. 1.8 billion people on this planet speak English. How did that happen? How did that happen? Well, if you have your Bibles with you, go ahead and turn to Genesis. Genesis 12, verse 1. If you don't have your Bibles, go ahead and pull it out and make sure what I'm telling you is true. But there are a lot of reasons that nations can grow to dominate, you know, their geographical landscape or the geopolitical landscape. But here we'll see in Genesis the number one reason, the primary reason that trumps all the other factors combined. Now, this is why some nations turn into empires. Genesis 12, verse 1. Now the Eternal said unto Abraham, get you out of your country and from your kindred and from your father's house unto a land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless you, and curse them that curse you, and in you shall all the families of the earth be blessed. So here God's telling Abraham, get up, Abraham, just do what I tell you, do what I say, and I will make you a great nation. I'll make you a nation so great, Abraham, that the whole earth will be blessed. Just do what I tell you. Now, we know this prophecy here is dual. It's talking about the spiritual blessings of grace, of this prophecy that Christ would come from Abraham's seed. But it's also talking about national and physical blessings of greatness. So here's this fantastic promise made to Abraham about national greatness, that Abraham's descendants would be so great that they would impact the whole world. But the point is, I'm from these scriptures, and the point is that it's God that makes nations great. That's the reason that nations become great, and that's very clear from scripture. You can go to a lot of scriptures in the Bible that talk about how God places nations, that God sets the boundaries of nations, that God raises up kings and brings down kings. That was true. That's been true not only in biblical Israel times, but all throughout history. It was the same in the past. It's still true today. And it's especially true of Great Britain. If you know your Bible, if you place any value on your Bible at all, this is an undeniable fact of history. You can't get around this fact of history. It's God that makes nations great. But how is it that God fulfills those prophecies? How does he work out his will? How does he cause nations to prosper? Before we get to those questions, it's time for a quick break. You're listening to KPCG.FM, 101.3 on FM dial. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Why did Great Britain have such a positive influence on the world? Was it because Britain was just better? Were the British inherently more powerful and more equitable? Great Britain spread not only its language, but advancements in agriculture, industry, science, commerce, banking, infrastructure, education, and the list goes on. Entire nations, great nations, have their common law and their representative governments because of the influence of Great Britain. The empire served its own interests, to be sure, but it also advanced its beliefs. It spent much of its treasure, its sailors, its soldiers, and its lives to fight slavery and to rid the world of barbarous practices. Not always because it was economical, but because it was right. Where did those beliefs come from? What were those laws based on? Some may argue that they're just common sense. Some may say that the British are, or were, inherently a better people. Britain's laws were better. Its virtues were better. But not because its people were naturally better. It's because of what Britain's laws were based on. British law traces back beyond the Empire. It traces back beyond England, Scotland, Wales, or Ireland. It traces back through Britain's earliest ancestors. This heritage reaches back not hundreds of years, but thousands of years. It links directly back to a surprising yet familiar source. The virtues and laws of Great Britain don't trace back to a few philosophers and theorists scattered across the past few centuries. They aren't the result of impersonal forces and random historical texts. They trace back to one source. That source was an absolutely perfect law and government. And through the centuries and the millennia, the tighter Britain has clung to that source, the better its laws have been. Understanding that source explains where and why our British ancestors succeeded and where and why they failed. And more to the point, it explains what we today so sorely lack. To find out where British culture originated, read Britain's 4,000-year-old history. This book is adapted from The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong. That book was read by 6 million people around the world. Far more than a Times bestseller. Request Britain's 4,000-year-old history and prove the identity and future of Britain for yourself. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to The Trumpet Daily. I'm Robert Morley, your host for today. But no need to fear, Stephen Fleury will be back tomorrow. We've been talking about how a tiny, isolated island nation located in the cold North Atlantic was able to become this enormous history, actually the biggest empire in world history. And we've been talking about how that happened. You know, what made it this fantastic company or commonwealth of nations, the most fantastic one to have ever existed. And as we've been saying, the Bible is very clear on this. It's, you know, it's God that ultimately makes nations great. But let's go ahead and pick up this discussion again. But let's turn over to Genesis 48, verse 17. And if you have your Bibles, go ahead and open them up. Make sure that what I'm telling you is the truth. Follow along if you'd like. But here in Genesis 48, we're breaking into the middle of the story here. The patriarch Jacob is getting old and he's getting ready to die. And he calls his grandsons to him. He calls Ephraim and Manasseh to him to pass on a special blessing on them. That the same promises, the same promises of national greatness that were promised to him by his father Isaac and by his grandfather Abraham. Picking up the story here in verse 17, we see this pivotal prophecy when it comes to understanding why Britain became Great Britain. Verse 17, and when Joseph saw that his father had laid up his right hand upon the head of Ephraim, it displeased him, and he held up his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head unto Manasseh's head. And Joseph said unto his father, not so, my father, for this is the firstborn. Put your right hand upon his head. And his father refused and said, I know it, my son, I know it. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. But truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his seed shall become a multitude of nations. And he blessed them that day, saying, in you shall Israel bless, saying, God make you like Ephraim and as Manasseh. And he set Ephraim before Manasseh. So here we see the story of Jacob passing down the birthright, those promises of national greatness and wealth to his two grandchildren. The older son, Manasseh, was to become the single great nation, while the younger son, Ephraim, was to become this company of nations or this colonizing power. His descendants were to become a commonwealth of nations. And the Bible reveals in detail who those descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh became. And if you want proof about that, we don't have time to get into all the proof of that today. But if you want proof on who those descendants became, you need to read the book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong. It's a fantastic read. You can go ahead and call in. You can go to the trumpet.com website and order yourself a free copy of that book. I'm not going to go into the proof here, but as that book brings out, Manasseh became that single great nation, the United States of America, and Ephraim became Britain and the British Commonwealth of Nations. And if there's one thing that I would like you to take away from this Trumpet Daily today, if there's one thing that I can encourage you to do, it's to order yourself a copy of that book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. It's a book that over 6 million people have read, that 6 million people have had their lives changed by reading this book. If you take the time to read this book and if you understand it, it'll make the Bible come alive in a way that has never come alive before, in a way that's impossible without understanding what this book says. It makes the Bible come alive and understandable in a way that you probably haven't realized before. So go ahead and order yourself a copy of that book. It's absolutely free. What do you have to lose? But today, I want to take a look at how exactly God made Britain Great Britain. You know, how did he make him into that greatest company of nations the world has ever seen? And I want to do this because I think it's a super inspiring story and because it has lessons for America. You know, America stands in the position Britain did 100 years ago, at the peak of its influence, at the peak of its wealth, at the peak of its empire. And now the signs are increasingly evident and obvious, very obvious for anybody who's paying attention, that America is following Britain towards the sunset. So let's go ahead and take a close look at Great Britain. You know, Great Britain is an incredibly unique nation. Geographically speaking, its set of of physical features and natural resources perfectly situated it to become a colonizing people, perfectly situated it to encourage its people to go out and colonize the world. But how exactly did God do that? How did he make sure that Britain would become that prophesied company of nations, that greatest empire the world has ever seen? Go ahead and turn over to Acts 17, verse 26. Here's an important principle that we have to understand. I'm just going to begin reading here. Acts 17, verse 26, speaking of God, and has made of one blood all nations of men to dwell on the face of the earth, and has determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation. See, it's God, right, that places the boundary of the nations. He places the nations where they are located. It is God that raises up kings, etc. It's God that determines the times before appointed, that determines when nations will rise to prominence and how they will do that. Verse 27, that they should seek the eternal, and happily they might feel after him and find him, though he be not far from every one of us. See, nations are put in their geographical places that they might seek after God, that they should seek the eternal. By studying geography, by studying place, a nation should be able to find God. And nowhere is this more true than with Ephraim and Manasseh, with Britain and the United States. We should, by studying their geography, be able to, you know, by studying their geography, their physical blessings, their natural resources, where they're located, we should be able to see God's hand in prophecy. Geography really does reveal God's hand in prophecy. The geography of Great Britain reveals God. Verse 28 says, "For in him we live and move and have our being, as certain also of your own poets have said, for we are also his offspring." See, even our own poets could see that we are his offspring. Now, by looking at geography, by understanding that God placed the nations where they are, people should be able to see God's hand in action. So let's take a closer look at exactly how God used geography to ensure that Great Britain would become that prophesied company of nations. You know, in the physical realm, there are a lot of physical reasons that nations become great. On the physical level, there's a lot of physical factors, things like natural resources, landforms, climate, you know, how close you are to your enemies, how close you are to your allies. All these things work together to shape and mold a nation. You know, geography. There's a saying in real estate, right? You've all heard it. Location, location, location. Well, in geopolitics, when it comes to nations, it's the same thing. It's geography, geography, geography. Their resources, their natural landscapes, all affect the action those nations take. They affect the relative wealth, the advancement. They affect the levels of technology available to those nations. Some of you might be familiar with Jeremy Paxman. He's a fairly well-known author and geographer. This is what he wrote in one of his books. He said, quote, "Geography makes history. And if such a thing as national psychology exists, it too may be made by geography." See, even national psychology, the characteristics of people, the characteristics of nations can be determined by geography. Now, does that sound a little preposterous? Are you a little skeptical when you hear that? Well, let's take a look at Great Britain. Let's take a look at Great Britain. Do you think that its situation as an island nation has affected the traits of its people? I mean, that makes sense to me. Now, what's the defining accomplishment of Great Britain? Well, obviously, it's the national characteristic of colonization, right? Of going out, of setting up colonies around the world. Well, today you'll see that geography virtually forced Britain into being a colonizing people. All right, remember back to that promise, that prophecy in Genesis 48. You know, God promised to Ephraim that its descendants would become this company of nations, that it would become this colonizing people. You know, and in other scriptures, you can see that God prophesied that Ephraim's descendants would become, you know, as numerous as the sands on the seashore, that his children would possess the world's most strategic sea gates or sea lanes, that Ephraim's descendants would possess the gates of their enemies. So doesn't it make sense that God would place Ephraim in an environment that would naturally make them a colonizing people, and a people whose livelihoods depended on controlling trade and commerce. So let's look specifically at some of Britain's geography. What's Britain's defining feature? What's Britain's defining geographical feature? Well, I'd argue it's probably its coastlines, its harbors, right? Its inlets, its rivers, its northern forests. You know, of all nations of this world, Britain really was uniquely and perfectly situated and suited to become a naval power. All right, so for example, in the Age of Sail, the British Isles were covered in oak, in birch, and even pine trees. These northern forests gave Britain a huge advantage over many of its enemies, especially Spain and Portugal, its chief rivals at this time. Those nations had to import timber. Here, Britain had its own forests. During the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, it was reported that the Spanish, you know, asked one of their ambassadors to sneak up and actually set fire to the forest of Dean, hoping that it would give Spain an advantage in the naval war, the battle for supremacy of the oceans that was coming, that they knew was coming. And Britain knew that its security depended on being a naval power. The British knew how vulnerable they were to invasion without having that strong navy. Going all the way back to Roman times, Britain was constantly invaded by raiders that would sail up the rivers and plunder their churches and their towns. Later on, it was the Vikings who really drove this point home to the natives in Britain. You know, there's stories of how the Vikings raided all up and down Europe, even down to Spain. But it was Britain that took the brunt of these raids. And it was Britain that consequently developed a national fear of invasion by sea. You know, this geographic vulnerability fostered the creation of naval defenses in Britain. The people were very concerned about being protected from the oceans. Britain's climate, it also played a role in developing the national characteristics and even the industry of Britain that would make them a colonizing people. You know, during the 16th to 19th centuries, Britain went through what's called a little ice age. And it affected pretty much every type of food production in Britain. During the coldest times in the Little Ice Age, Britain's growing season was shortened by between 1 and 2 months. I mean, that's devastating when you're growing crops. And historical records show how the prices of food, of wheat, of rye, for example, these crops that they used to grow in great abundance in Great Britain, skyrocketed because of the shortages. And Britain was even was even known for growing wines and grapes. But the changing climate decimated those industries. England experienced great hardship during this time period. But what was the result of that? What was the impact on Great Britain? Well, the British people were forced to turn to the one food supply that they had left, right? They turned to fishing. And because of this, a culture of seafaring was being built in Britain. Also, during the reign of Elizabeth I, during this cold climate, this period of abnormally cold climate, it had the impact of vastly reducing the wealth of Great Britain. It turned this nation that at one point that was fairly wealthy, it really impacted them. And it was at this time period, and it's not a coincidence, that Britain adopted this policy of attacking Spanish shipping as a way to supplement its national income. Right, that's how Britain funded its government during this time. And Britain, because of that, began to invest much more heavily in sea power. And with Spain threatening Britain, Britain did everything it could to build its navy, to build out its naval resources. So this culture of seafaring was being ingrained in Britain. Later on, Britain's natural resources would play another role in making sure that Britain would have the world's dominant navy. I'm talking about Britain's coal deposits. As Britain's navy modernized, these coal deposits gave it a reliable domestic source of fuel. In fact, Britain had some of the largest coal deposits in Europe, and it was one of the first navies to adopt coal power because it had this secure, domestic, abundant source of energy. That coal also allowed Britain to lead the world in iron production, right? During the Industrial Revolution, there was this time period in Britain, in British history, where Great Britain produced more iron than France, Germany, and Russia combined. More iron was being produced in Great Britain because of its coal deposits, because of its iron deposits, than its next three biggest competitors combined. And iron, as you know, was the metal of war. Britain had all kinds, has all kinds of mineral wealth. Britain also had vast copper and lead deposits, two other metals essential to naval construction. Britain was mining these metals, you know, all the way back to Romans time, the time of the Romans. Britain, during the Age of Sail, was able to put copper in the hulls of their warships, making their ships faster than their competitors. And what I find most interesting about this was that, you know, Britain understood that to make their ships fast and stronger, they needed to coat their ships with copper. But they had never been able to do it because copper was just so expensive for them at that time. They never had the money to do this. But just at the time in British history where they needed that the most, at the time during the Revolutionary War, when France and Spain and the Netherlands all declared war on Britain, at a time of Britain's probably greatest need, or one of its greatest needs, Britain suddenly discovers the biggest copper mine on the islands in its history. And just as it needs this copper, copper starts flooding the markets and pushing the price down. Suddenly, Britain can afford to retrofit its navy. Virtually its whole navy is now coated with these copper-bottom ships, which are faster and stronger and need less repairs than their enemies. Once again, geography coming to the aid of Great Britain right when it needed it most. You know, there's tons of examples. There's many examples of how geography helped Britain turn into this seafaring and hence this colonial power. A couple of years ago, I came across this article in the Daily Mail talking about how Britain's geography played this key role in developing its naval forces. It talked about how if you were to visit the River Fall between the city of Tororo and Falmouth Harbor, you'd see an astonishing sight. And it talked about how ships were lined up nose to tail, bow to stern, all the way up and down this river, a fleet of empty mothballed ships. And this article talked about how the last time this river saw so many ships was during the Normandy D-Day invasions. There was this whole ghost fleet of ships lining this river because of the economic crisis. But what I found interesting in this article, it talked about how the terminus of this river was the deepest natural harbor in Europe. And Britain is just filled with these seafaring advantages. You know, it has the deepest, has two of the deepest harbors in the world, natural harbors. Didn't have to do anything. Of the world's seven largest natural harbors, two are in Great Britain. Five of seven were controlled by Great Britain throughout the Commonwealth. I mean, do those sorts of things happen by chance? You know, Sydney Harbor, Halifax, Nova Scotia, you know, Cornwall, Dorset, you know, Poole and Dorset, all in Ireland, Cork in Ireland. All of the, is it by chance that Britain would have so many advantageous ports? Well, I don't think it was. And I think you're starting to see why Great Britain became a seafaring power. You know, in the article in the Daily Mail talked about how virtually all of Britain is accessible by navigable rivers. Rivers that can be used for commerce. There's no point in England that's more than 75 miles from the ocean. You know, Britain's geography just perfectly situated it for becoming a naval power. Then you could talk about how oil was discovered. Britain discovered oil in the 1850s in Scotland. That led to the North Sea discovery. And you know, the rest of Europe wasn't even pumping oil in Northern Europe until the 1930s. And this let Britain modernize its navy again and become, you know, adopt diesel-powered navy and have an advantage again, help it hang on to its empire. We could talk about Britain's small geographical area. You know, it's tiny compared to the United States. You can fit 17 Great Britons in the United States. And the shortage of land that was hoarded by the nobles, you know, that this caused the people of the British Isles to really head out in search of free land, to head out to the colonies. Geographically, there was this push that occurred in the British Isles. The potato famine in Ireland pushed out these people to the colonies. And then from the colonies, there was this geographic pull. There was all these resources that were there for the using, for the exploiting, that called the people of Great Britain. See, the more you study geography, the more you should see God's hand at work. And doesn't it just make sense that God would have situated Britain in one place, the one place in the world that would practically guarantee it would become a colonizing people, a people with an empire that the sun never set on, that would provide the conditions needed to fulfill all those blessings that were promised to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob and down to Joseph and to Ephraim. Here's a bit of a teaser from Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. Reading from this book, here's Mr. Armstrong speaking. He says, "So, beginning in AD 1800 to 1803, after 2,520 years, God did cause the birthright nations, you know, Ephraim and Manasseh, and them only, to become suddenly the recipients of such national wealth, greatness, and power as no nation or empire ever before had acquired. Today, they, the British and Americans, descendants of only one original tribe, Joseph, came into possession of more than two-thirds, almost three-quarters, of all the cultivated resources and wealth of the whole world. Britain and America came into possession of every such major sea gate in the world. So we must be modern Israel. World War II hinged on those gates. They had become not only strategic passes, but the world's greatest fortifications. More than half of all the tillable, cultivatable, temperate zone lands of this earth came after AD 1800 to the possession of our two great powers alone." And then Mr. Armstrong goes through and just chronicles all the vast forest lands of North America and Australia and the fields of agriculturally productive cropland and natural resources, how the British Empire and the United States produced far more gold and all these other minerals than the rest of the world combined, and how they produced more wealth and possessed more material wealth than the rest of the world combined, and how fast that was given to Britain and the United States. And it really just emphasizes this point that it's God that makes nations great, right? It's God that brings nations to power. All these geographical blessings are not by chance. Britain did not gain an empire in a fit of absent-mindedness, as some historians claim, at least not the way that they mean it. I mean, it's true. Britain did not set out to become this great colonizing empire. There was no national drive where people were trying to become, you know, leaders were trying to become this colonizing empire. There was no great plan to become this huge empire around the world. But there was an unseen hand making sure that all that would happen. And by studying geography, we should be able to see that incredibly unique geography of Great Britain. We should be able to see, you know, far more importantly, we should be able to see God's hand behind it. And it should really be a warning to us as well. It should be. Today, those geographical blessings that made Britain great are being taken away. You know, the North Sea oil is failing. The environmentalists have shut down much of Britain's coal mining. Britain no longer produces iron ore at all. The North Sea fishing industry is a fraction of its former self. Britain's ports are old and run down. Its shipbuilding industry is all but gone. And instead of British companies investing around the world, much of Britain is owned by foreigners. See, those blessings given to ancient Abraham and his descendants were a promise, right? They were a promise that God has completely fulfilled. But whether or not those blessings would be permanent, now that was contingent. That was contingent on national obedience to God's laws. Right? God made promises and he kept those promises. But whether or not we were to hold on to those blessings, that's on whether or not those descendants, you know, the United States and Britain today, remained obedient to God's laws. And now Britain, what about the colonies? Well, Britain's lost that empire. It took basically 10 years for Britain to lose its entire empire from the 1950s to 1960s, and Britain's empire was gone. It was fast. It was dramatic. It was a chain reaction. And that, too, should be a warning for America. You know, how fast empires can fall and it can be very, very dramatic. Well, we're coming to the end of the program. We've been discussing the incredibly unique geography of Great Britain and how that was just a direct blessing from God, and how it basically foreordained that Britain would become the greatest empire this world has ever seen, that it would become a colonizing power unlike any other in history. And we've been discussing how geography, by studying it, we should be able to see God's hand in prophecy, how God fulfills prophecy, how he raises up nations, and how he brings them down. If you want to know more about this, if you want to know more about the prophecies of the Bible that concern the United States, that concern Great Britain, I would just encourage you to order Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. Just go ahead to the trumpet.com website and click on the literature tab. Your order is, it will be absolutely free. There's no cost. There's no obligation. There's no follow-up. This service, this free book is provided to you in the knowledge that it will help you better understand your Bible. So I encourage you to go ahead and order yourself a free copy of The United States and Britain in Prophecy. As I mentioned, we're at the end of our program. Thank you for joining us today for the Trumpet Daily. Thank you to Stephen Fleury for inviting me on the program. Thank you to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Abraham Blondeau, Josh Sloan, and all the others working tirelessly behind the scenes. Tune in tomorrow, same time, same place, 101.3 on FM dial and at KPCG FM online and at thetrumpet.com. Looking forward to talking to you again, and keep watching your world.